Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, July 24th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, and Ellie Gerzon. Tamara Nassar and Asa Wynn-Stanley are off this week. It's day 657 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up, we'll be joined by our contributor, Donya Abusita in Gaza, a kindergarten teacher and writer. We'll talk to her about how she and those around her are trying to survive and what gives them hope to endure through this Holocaust. Later on in the program, John will cover the latest resistance news from Gaza, where an ambush aimed at capturing soldiers hit Israeli troops in Khan Yunis. But first, let's take a look at the news. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombarded areas across Gaza this week, killing 646 Palestinians and injuring more than 3,400 between July 16th and July 23rd, according to records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. On July 22nd, 15 Palestinians were killed and 50 were wounded when Israel targeted tents of displaced families in the Beach or Shati refugee camp west of Gaza City. The same day, another 15 Palestinians were killed, including six children, in an airstrike on a residential building in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. The United Nations says that paramedics were also injured in that attack, and that at least one ambulance was damaged as the residential building was located near an ambulance station. On July 21st, Israel bombed a kindergarten in the Burej refugee camp in central Gaza in two successive strikes. Images and video show small children streaming out of the classrooms with their backpacks on, their faces bloodied and terrified, being comforted by parents, teachers, and caregivers. Just a few days before, Israel bombed the Abu Helu school shelter in the Burej refugee camp. These attacks happened during a ground invasion of central Gaza this past week. On July 20th, according to a statement by the World Food Programme, or WFP, their 25-truck convoy carrying vital food assistance crossed Zikim Crossing in northern Gaza and subsequently encountered large crowds of civilians anxiously waiting to access desperately needed food supplies. Quote, "As the convoy approached, the surrounding crowd came under fire from Israeli tanks, snipers, and other gunfire, resulting in mass casualties," the WFP stated. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported that 73 people had been killed and more than 150 were injured in the attack, some in critical condition. Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, the director of Al Shifa Hospital, stated that most of the injuries were in the head or chest, and that the hospital was overwhelmed with the influx of casualties. Based on available reports, this appears to be the highest number of fatalities among Palestinians seeking food in a single location and on a single day since May 27th, the WFP stated. Forced displacement continues across Gaza, with the Israeli army squeezing Palestinians into smaller and smaller areas. A displacement order on Sunday, July 20th, covered four neighborhoods and nearly 6 square kilometers of Deir el-Balah. The UN said that their initial estimates indicate that between 50,000 and 80,000 people were in the area at the time the order was issued, including some 30,000 people sheltering in 57 displacement sites. At least 1,000 families had already fled the area. The newly designated displacement area includes several humanitarian warehouses, 4 primary health clinics, 4 medical points, and critical water infrastructure, the Southern Gaza Desalination Plant, 3 water wells, 1 water reservoir, 1 solid waste dumping site, and 1 wastewater pumping station, Any damage to this infrastructure will have life-threatening consequences, the UN added. With this latest order, the area of Gaza under displacement orders or within Israeli militarized zones has risen to 88%, leaving 2.1 million civilians squeezed into a fragmented 12% of the strip, where essential services have collapsed. The new order cuts through Deir al-Balah all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, further splintering the strip. It will limit the ability of the UN and our partners to move safely and effectively within Gaza, choking humanitarian access when it is needed most, the UN stated. In addition to relentless attacks on school shelters, homes, and buildings, services have stopped at 6 health facilities in the Gaza Strip due to a fuel shortage because of Israel's continued closure of the crossings since March. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza described the ongoing obstruction of fuel and medical supplies as, quote, a deliberate attempt to destroy what remains of the health system. The United Nations says that hospitals in Gaza, quote, are overwhelmed and cannot cope with the influx of patients due to the lack of supplies and fuel. Local health authorities said that in the past few days, several of their health facilities have shut down due to the lack of fuel. More hospitals, including Al-Shifa, are at imminent risk of shutting down within the next few days. Israel's ongoing ban on fuel into Gaza has forced the main desalination plant in Gaza City to shut down. The Gaza municipality warned that the city has entered a phase of extreme thirst due to the lack of fuel to run the plant. In a statement, the municipality said that the worsening fuel crisis has further deepened the water shortage. Large areas are no longer receiving water, and most wells are out of service. Some 1.2 million displaced people and residents now face the threat of severe thirst as water sources collapse and urgent humanitarian intervention remains absent, the municipality stated. The Samir Project, a mutual aid organization in Gaza, warned that the drivers of the water distribution trucks they work with said that they are running out of gas and that, quote, in a week or two, mutual aid groups won't be able to deliver water trucks to people anymore. Israel's starvation of Gaza has hit catastrophic levels. Palestinians are reporting that there simply is no more food left, with markets empty and stockpiles depleted. Reporter Nahed Hajjaj posted on Friday, July 18th, quote, do not be surprised when we journalists stop covering news here. I swear by God that today I could not get up from the hunger. There is no food. Even if someone has money, there is nothing in the market to even purchase. We are all starving. We are all dying. On Sunday, July 20th, the Palestinian Health Ministry held a protest of sirens in what they say was an urgent warning and an alarm toward the deteriorating starvation and health situation in the besieged strip. Quote, our sirens today are the voice of the hungry and the bereaved who are left to die without the minimum means of survival, the ministry said. That was on July 20th. That day, the health ministry said that it had recorded 86 deaths from starvation, 76 children and 10 adults, what it is calling a silent massacre. The number has since risen to at least 101 as of Tuesday. Al Jazeera journalist Anas Al-Sharif broke down in tears describing the scene outside of a hospital on Sunday, where people were collapsing in hunger and others were being brought to the hospital with injuries from Israeli attacks.
The
That was Anas al-Sharif. He appealed to all international press freedom and human rights organizations on Wednesday over renewed threats against him by the Israeli military. He said, quote, I reaffirm that I, Anas al-Sharif, am a journalist with no political affiliations. My only mission is to report the truth from the ground, as it is, without bias. At a time when a deadly famine is ravaging Gaza, speaking the truth has become, in the eyes of the occupation, a threat. A group of journalists announced that they were going on hunger strike and would just be consuming salt water in protest of Israel's mass starvation policy and the deteriorating situation across Gaza. Our contributor Abu Bakr Abed wrote, quote, I had always been next to those journalists at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir el-Balah. Seeing them drinking salted water has ripped my heart into pieces. There's no way this world can ever be forgiven. The group of journalists declared that, quote, we are on an open hunger strike until the smallest child in Gaza can eat. The reporters called on, quote, the free people of the world to stand up and participate in the empty stomach movement for the oppressed, the hungry, and the thirsty in the Gaza Strip. Members of Gaza's civil defense joined the hunger strike as well. Mahmoud Basal, the civil defense spokesperson, said, quote, the main reason that pushed me to go on a hunger strike is that I see children who cannot eat. I see men, women, patients who cannot feed themselves. The sick are unable to feed themselves, he said, adding that more than 1,000 people have been killed while looking for food and 85 children have starved to death. We are living a daily catastrophe. People are falling to the ground. They faint out of exhaustion, out of hunger, out of starvation, he added. As long as aid does not enter for the citizens here in a humane manner, I continue to call upon and appeal to the world, Basal said in a post on social media. Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis stated that 15 more Palestinians died from starvation on Tuesday, bringing the total number to 101, including 80 children. The toll of martyrs due to hunger and malnutrition is increasing rapidly, the hospital said. Dr. Ambarine Salimi, an American doctor working inside the hospital, described the conditions in Gaza as catastrophic. Everything here is extremely cruel, she said. No food, no medicine, no shelter, no safety. Everything is lost under siege and a genocide war. Three-month-old Yahya al-Najjar died due to starvation this week, the third infant to be killed by Israel's starvation in a 24-hour period, according to journalist Ahmed al-Najjar. Israel continues to deliberately and systematically prevent the entry of baby formula and specialized nutritional supplements for infants. Dr. Fida al-Nadi at Nasser Medical Complex spoke to reporters about the death of babies from starvation.
Dr. Fida al-Nadi, a pediatrician and ICU doctor at Nasser Medical Hospital, the last hospital working in the South Gaza. We lost a child, Yahya Najjar, who is 3 months old infant. We have lost him because of lack of nutrition, and he has no milk, and his mother could not afford breastfeeding for him. So we have lost him, and like all other children in Gaza, and the most vulnerable period is during the infancy, and early infancy is most vulnerable. Every day here in Nasser Medical Hospital, we lost children. Every day we lose from 1 to 2 cases of children, especially infants, due to malnutrition. And of course, it affects all aspects of their life. It affects immunity and makes them more vulnerable to infections and may die to infection. During the previous months, we have lost more than 73 cases of children due to malnutrition. And this number is increasing every day.
That was Dr. Fida al-Nadi at Nasser Medical Complex. The Lemkin Institute for Genocide Prevention stated on Monday that it was calling on every leader in the world, quote, to step in immediately with measures that ensure food and water gets into Gaza right now, No more discussions, meetings, reports, sessions, summits, the Institute said. Get food and water into Gaza now. Quote, even if it takes bypassing the reports, meetings, endless conferences, parliamentary sessions, UN sessions, and all the other regular diplomatic channels that have led nowhere, just do it. Reporter Wadia Abu Al Saud covered a protest of children in the streets on July 19th, marching with empty stomachs and chanting, no to hunger, no to death. They came out to the streets not to play, rather to scream out of hunger, Abu Al Saud says. Their bellies are empty and their eyes are looking for a bite, for mercy, for a homeland whose children are not starving.
والله لأخرج أكبر مثيرة من الأطفال لتزوب قطاع غزة كامل بأمعاء خاوية لتقول للعالم أننا جائعين أننا معطشين أننا يمارس بحقنا أبشع الجرائم التي عرفتها الإنسانية والتي لم تعرفها الإنسانية هذا صوت السكالة هذا صوت المكلومين والمجوعين والمعطشين خرجوا الآن الأطفال ليزوبوا الشوارع في قطاع غزة ليحكوا للعالم مدى الظلم التي يتعرض له أهلنا في قطاع غزة من تجويع وتعطيش بأي قانون وبأي دين وبأي حق تستخدم إسرائيل حرب التجويع ضد هؤلاء الأطفال المجوعين والمعطشين هؤلاء الأطفال الآن يخرجوا بأمعاء خاوية يخرجوا بأمعاء خاوية ليقولوا للقاسي والداني أننا جوعى أننا معطشين أننا جائعين هذه أقل ما يمكن أن يفعلوه
Meanwhile, Israeli and American forces stationed at the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites continue to trap, injure, and kill starving Palestinians every day, while preventing the United Nations and its partner organizations from distributing life-saving food aid with dignity and safety, as thousands of tons of food remain blocked on the other side of the Israeli crossings. On Sunday, July 20th, Israeli forces killed at least 92 Palestinians who tried to obtain meager parcels of flour and food aid in what Euromed Human Rights Monitor described as one of the most heinous massacres against starving civilians. Quote, the occupation army ordered the civilians to approach aid trucks with their hands raised, a clear sign of surrender, and then opened fire on them without provocation, the rights group said, adding that thousands of desperate civilians, driven by days of total flour shortages, headed early on Sunday to the Al-Waha area in northwest Gaza City after reports circulated that flour-laden trucks had entered via the Zikim crossing. In a desperate attempt to feed their families, many individuals rushed to the site. When the first groups arrived, Israeli tanks were already stationed in the area. Soldiers then used loudspeakers to command, raise your hands and walk in front of the tanks. Those who want flour, come forward. Around 200 civilians complied. As they neared the aid trucks, Israeli forces suddenly opened heavy fire directly at their heads, instantly killing dozens. Others were left crawling, wounded, and bleeding. In a separate incident also on July 20th, Euromed said, quote, Israeli forces shot and killed six more starving civilians near a food distribution point run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation in Rafah as people attempted to access aid. On Wednesday, the Palestinian Health Ministry stated that 34 Palestinians were killed and more than 640 injured between Tuesday and Wednesday at these so-called aid distribution sites, raising the death toll to 1,060, with more than 7,200 injured since the GHF opened 8 weeks ago in late May. Dr. Nick Maynard, a British surgeon working in Gaza, told the BBC that based on the injuries he's treating, Israeli soldiers in Gaza are reportedly turning the targeting of Palestinian children into a systematic human hunting game.
I've seen, I think, probably a dozen now seriously injured young boys who have been shot in the abdomen or the chest. One of them, a 12-year-old, died on the operating table because the injuries were so severe. And they're all from gunshot wounds. And they all describe to me And their families described to me, and indeed colleagues of mine, Gazan medical colleagues who are looking for food as well, have gone to these same distribution sites and witnessed these injuries as well. They're all describing that they're being shot by Israeli soldiers or by the quadcopters, the drones which are being remotely controlled by the Israelis, and fire often indiscriminately, often targeted. And I'm seeing a very clear, we're all seeing a very clear pattern of injuries. I've seen the abdominal injuries, but my colleagues in the emergency room describe a very clear pattern where on particular days they'll see different body parts targeted. So on one day they'll all be abdominal gunshot wounds, on another day they'll all be head gunshot wounds or neck gunshot wounds, on another day they'll be arm or leg gunshot wounds. And on last Saturday there were four young teenage boys all brought in very rapidly in succession with gunshot wounds to their testicles. So they'd clearly been targeted to their testicles, and this is a pattern that we're seeing every day, that these young teenage boys are systematically being targeted. And it's almost as if a game is being played, that they're deciding to shoot the head today and the neck tomorrow and the testicles the day after.
That was Dr. Nick Maynard working in Gaza. Meanwhile, an American mercenary who had worked for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation admitted in an interview with Israel's Channel 12 this week that, quote, the aid centers treated the population very badly and put them in danger. The GHF system, quote, can't be fixed. It has to be put an end to, adding that if the UN had the resources and coordination that this mechanism has, it would work much better. The mercenary who recently resigned said that, quote, once Palestinians finished collecting the aid at the site, the American guards opened fire, shooting at them, at their legs, at the dirt mounds to force them to leave. He also described an incident where a GHF member of staff threw a stun grenade directly at a Palestinian woman who collapsed and fell to the floor. That was the moment I realized I couldn't go on, he said. In response to the confession, the Gaza government media office said on Wednesday that those statements, quote, represent damning testimony to the criminal and inhumane nature of this organization, which hides behind the guise of relief work while actually playing a security and military role in areas of forced displacement, subject to clear intelligence and security agendas. And if people manage to survive the GHF killing fields, the food parcels from the private U.S.-Israeli mercenary corporation continue to be wholly insufficient for people's critical needs. Dr. Ahmad Al-Fara, the director of pediatrics at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, said that Palestinian families have come to the hospital suffering from serious health problems linked to consuming spoiled food. Dr. Al-Fara told Al Jazeera that he asked two parents, quote, didn't you smell the foul odor of the can of food that you ate? The father said, doctor, what can we do? This is all we have. Al-Fara said that he wouldn't send his son to the GHF sites. Quote, I am afraid that he will go there and he will come back as a dead body. The GHF is a trap for killing, not for distributing food, he said. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed three Palestinian children this week. On July 18th, 13-year-old Amr Ali Ahmed Kabha was shot in the back at least seven times by Israeli soldiers in Yabad, near Jenin in the north. Defense for Children International Palestine reports that two Israeli military vehicles came from the Mevo Dotan settlement and military base, entered the village and took up positions in its northern area, where several soldiers exited their vehicles. Amr was walking around a road nearby, and he unknowingly approached the group of Israeli soldiers stationed at the site. Due to the circular bend in the road, the soldiers did not initially see him, nor was he aware of their presence. As Amr turned back and attempted to take cover, the soldiers opened fire on him, with live ammunition from a distance of 10 meters, or about 33 feet away, and he was struck with around seven bullets. 3 bullets in the back, 1 in the neck, 1 in the abdomen, 1 in the upper right thigh, and 1 in the groin. Amr fell to the ground as Israeli soldiers advanced toward him, preventing anyone from reaching him, including medical staff and ambulance teams. As news of Amr's injury quickly spread in the village, his father rushed directly to the scene. Despite the soldiers shouting and warning shots, he managed to reach and embrace Amr. According to the father, Amr was still alive at that time, using hand gestures to plead for medical help as he was unable to speak. Israeli soldiers handcuffed the father behind his back, severely beat him, and was forced to sit beside his bleeding child. The soldiers continued to detain both father and son, blocking ambulance access for approximately 40 minutes. Only after the soldiers were certain Amr had died, they allowed the ambulance to approach and transport him to the Yabad Government Emergency Center and then transferred to Jenin Government Hospital, where he was pronounced dead on arrival. Defense for Children International Palestine reported on Tuesday, July 22nd, that another boy, 15-year-old Ibrahim Majid Ali Nasser, was shot and killed by Israeli forces in the Palestinian town of Kabatia, south of Jenin. Ibrahim was allegedly throwing stones at Israeli soldiers during an Israeli military incursion into Kabatia, where he was shot from a distance of about 10 to 15 meters, or about 30 to 50 feet, away, striking him with a bullet in the right side of the chest that exited through the right shoulder. And on Wednesday, Israeli forces shot and killed 14-year-old Ibrahim Imad Ahmed Mahmoud Hamran Araba, south of Jenin, killing him instantly. He is the 35th child to be shot and killed by Israeli forces in 2025, according to statistics from Defense for Children International. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight The Dreams We Carry During Genocide by Asim Al-Nabih, writing from Gaza. Asim was our guest on last week's live stream. He's an engineer, a PhD researcher, and the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality. Asim writes, quote, "I'm not sure if I made a mistake promising my nieces and nephews something sweet in the middle of a famine. I searched Gaza City for days before I finally found a single bar of chocolate, hidden like a treasure in the ruins of this old city. I paid an outrageous price and brought it back, breaking it into 7 tiny pieces for the children, giving none to the adults. As each child took a piece, I imagined its sweetness on my tongue, wishing there had been more for the kids. A few minutes later, my beautiful 5-year-old niece, Lana, said quietly, 'Uncle Asim, do you know my dream?' I answered with curiosity, 'Please tell me, Lana.' 'My dream is to have a whole bar of chocolate,' little Lana said. For a moment, I couldn't respond. How has chocolate become a dream for a child in the 21st century? Why is it impossible to grant even the small wish? That moment stayed with me. And then I eventually realized Israel is the reason we and our children cannot fulfill even the simplest dreams. Not poverty, not fate, but occupation, siege, and war. Israel." That moment reminded me of another day during the genocide. I was standing on the street when I overheard children talking about their dreams, their small and innocent hopes if they survived. Some wanted to see their martyred siblings again. Others dreamed of eating hot bread or chicken. One little girl said she wished for running water in her bathroom so she wouldn't have to carry heavy buckets over long distances. All of these were basic human rights, things no child should have to wish for. But the voice that really hit me was from a little blonde boy who whispered, "I just want to hear my mother's voice calling me in the morning for school. That's my dream." I knelt beside him and asked gently, "Is that really your biggest dream, buddy?" He nodded and said, "It's an impossible dream. My school was destroyed and my mother was killed." I didn't know what to say until one of the children asked me, "Uncle, what's your dream?" I paused only for a second before replying, "My dream is for all your dreams to come true." Those are excerpts from The Dreams We Carry During Genocide by Asim Al-Nabih, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. Watch last week's interview we did with Asim on our YouTube page. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. Photographer Hanin Salem captured an image of four young boys in Gaza City, taking a rest after playing. Two of them have their rollerblades on and they smile for the camera. Hanin Salem says, quote, "As a photographer in Gaza, I constantly search for the life that insists on being born amidst all this death around me. My lens doesn't just capture destruction, it seeks out the flickers of humanity in the shadows. The child who survives the rubble with a smile, the laughter that hides behind the dust of bombed homes. In every corner of ash, there's a child turning debris into a playground, and an old bicycle into wings that fly him beyond the siege. They may not speak the language of philosophy, but they live its most complex truths with their bare feet, walking over shattered ground as if the earth hadn't bled, laughing in ways that defy the sorrow trying to nest in their hearts. In a single moment, destruction becomes the background, fear turns into a fading shadow, and life becomes a rusted bicycle ridden by a child who refuses to stop, as if teaching the world a lesson in survival. I asked one of them, 'Why do you play here?' He smiled and said, 'So we can laugh before the bombing starts again.' As if they know laughter is resistance, and that childhood, if not lived in its time, is buried with the first airstrike." That's from photographer Hanin Salem. You can find more of her exquisite photographs on her Instagram account at hanin.maher.salem. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague, Ali Abonima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Thank you so much for that. It's so hard to even know what to say faced with all this horror, but we have to bear witness to it. We have to let the world know about it. And I've had Asim's words on my mind all week since we spoke to him last week. It was a very haunting conversation in a sense. And the conversation we had with Dunya Abu Sitta reflects many of the things that you talked about, including dreams of the future that people have in Gaza, dreams of things that are just so ordinary that are impossible, seem impossible, but also dreams of the future. So we recorded this interview with Dunya a day or so ago, just because of the difficulty of connecting with Gaza. And as Nora said, Dunya is a kindergarten teacher and a writer and a longtime contributor to the Electronic Intifada. And she's an extraordinarily resilient person. She's also, as you'll hear, a student with hopes of completing her education as a doctor. So shall we go to the conversation with Dunya?
Let's do that. Thanks, Ali. Right.
Thank you so much for joining us and for walking some distance to reach a place where you could access the internet to speak to the world about the situation in Gaza. The other day, I sent you a message and I asked you how things were, and the answer you gave me really was very difficult and heartbreaking about the situation in Gaza with the widespread hunger. Tell us what the situation is now around you, what you're seeing, and what you and people around you are experiencing.
Actually, if I wanted to explain the certain circumstances and the situation around me, I didn't find enough word to explain it, because there are many difficulties in these days for food, fuel, medical services, and also education system is collapsing in these days. And all of these are collapsing because of food, which is the most necessary thing. As you know, Moslo divided the needs of a human being for 5 levels, which is the basic level is food, and you cannot turn to another levels even if you get the secure in this level. So food is the most necessary things for a human being to search for safety, education, and another systems in their lives. So in these days, as you read in the news, we are being starved. And this is a systematic starvation because since the beginning of March, there is no aid or any tank enter Gaza. And this is effect in each sides of our life. For example, the educations. I'm a student at university, and yesterday my university announced that all homework and assignment cancelled because of this situation. And also I take a course with British Council, and my professor also annoyed the same thing, that the meetings is cancelled until we can get better circumstances here, because no one have energy to do this. No one have energy to do the duties. If we are adults, cannot bear this. What about the children and the elders people?
Well, tell us about that. What are you seeing with your own eyes around you, among children, among elderly people? Just what's happening to ordinary people around you in Gaza?
Actually, it's difficult to explain everything, but I wanted to tell you about my best friend, which is Bara'a. She and her family was trapped days ago, and they are lost her brother, little brother, which is 11 years, only 11 years. And she actually don't have any reason to target them. They are targeting the tents. They are in Al-Mawasi area in Khan Yunis, and they targeted tents, and more than 20 people are injured and two murders. One of them is Aboud, which is 11 years old. And my sister has many injured in his shoulders. His sister also have injured in her ear, and other sisters, all of them are injured because of the circumstances. And after 2 days, they lost another boy in the same family, because this boy was went to Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, because the father of this boy was murdered at the beginning of the war. And was his uncle, Mahmoud, was taking and caring about them. And Mahmoud was killed in that attack. So the boy forced to go to Gaza Humanitarian Foundation for their sisters and youngest spring. And they also targeting them. And it's like, they don't allow to food and ads enter Gaza, and they are targeting to seek for ads from Gaza Humanitarian Foundations.
Donia, can you talk a little bit about the displacement orders that have come down, especially in central Gaza, in Deir al-Balah, in the last few days? These orders that the Israeli army are, you know, demanding that tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who have already been displaced multiple times now have to go. What is the mood in central Gaza? What are people supposed to do as they're being starved at the same time?
Let's start from the last month. I was evacuated from Khan Yunis to Deir al-Balah in Al Zawaida area. And actually, the last day in Khan Yunis wasn't easy. It's the most difficult days in my life, because attacks are so near. And I just spent 1 month here, and they are asking us to evacuate it again. And we don't have any idea to where to go because there are control all of Rafah City. And also most of Khan Yunis under their control and not allowed to enter it, just Al-Mawasi. And they are targeting tents in Al-Mawasi. And now they are start to ask people in middle area to evacuate it. But the people asking where we should go, there are no place. And since 2 days, the targeting, I hear the targeting in the east Deir el-Balah from the place I stay in. And people are start to evacuate it, but not all people, because there are many difficulties. The transportation is most difficult in these days because there are no few enter Gaza, and no any way they can and let people to evacuate it from one area, from one displacement area to another one. Also, the prices in these days for evacuation, it's very high, and not every family can bear this cost. And it's not the first time the family evacuation, because maybe each family evacuated multiple times, tens of times, so they cannot bear even a new one. I know families that say,
Hopefully we can get the connection back up.
Donia, are you there?
Yeah, there yes. We are.
Oh, okay, good. It froze for a minute, but yeah. But you're talking about families trying to evacuate, or
yeah, there are many difficulties to evacuate from one displacement area to another displacement, because there are difficulties in the transportations, because there are no few in this day enter Gaza, and no any way and any anything help people to evacuate from one area to another, because they need their necessary things to carry on. And also it cost money, it's very expensive for family. And as you know, from at the beginning of this war, many families lost their job and work, and they didn't evacuate it for the first time. Maybe it's 10th or more than 10th. For me, I think I evacuated more than 10 times. So it's hard to evacuate it more and more, and this costs much, and you need to bring the necessary thing from one place to another place, from one city to another city. And after at least 1 week or 1 month, they ask you to evacuate it to another place.
And so what are people doing? Are they just deciding to stay where they are, or are they evacuating?
Yes, most of family are decided to stay in, because also if they have some money, they wanted to pay some food for their kids and children. They don't want to give the money for evacuations, transportation.
Let's talk more about that, Dunya. And I'm sorry to ask about these details, because it's hard for us outside Gaza to know exactly what's happening, except by talking to people who are there and who are living through this genocide, through this deliberate famine. My question to you is, where you are, in the area where you are, is there any food available in the markets? So if somebody has money, can they buy food? Or is there nothing available? What's the situation where you are?
Actually, there is nothing available here in the middle area in the market. And literally the market is closed since 3 days and there is nothing. Some families went to Khan Yunis to buy something and other go to Gaza, and it's not a safe thing to take this risk, but they take this. Just imagine if your little kids are asking you for food and you don't have any ability to give them food as a father or as a mother. They are take this risk to just support their little children with the most necessary thing in this life.
And talk more about children. You are a teacher. You have cared for children throughout this war. How do parents, how do families try to cope with the hunger of their children? What different strategies do they have to try to cope with this intolerable situation?
Yes, yesterday I read a news and there was a kindergarten that targeted, and at that moment I just imagine my students in the same shoes, and I think if this happened to me or to my students, what I should do. And at the, for a short moment I just say, yes, it's bitter that I stopped teaching kids in this time, because there are many most of my students are evacuated in a different way, so in different areas, so we cannot get them in the same place. But we are trying to teach them online courses like short videos and handwriting, and they can immediately ask how to write and so on. And also for food for children, I live in the building, and I saw kids in the same building asking their mothers they want to eat, and the mothers and fathers these days don't have the power to give them the most necessary thing, and kids are asking and asking. For example, I'm asking my mother for food 3 days ago, and I just cry this because I didn't get one full meat for I think 2 weeks, and there she was have 1 kilo of rice, and she prepared it at the same time. We are saving it for the next days if there are nothing in Gaza, but we did it at the same time and we eat it. If as adult did this, what about the children and kids, which is they need a safe childhood and the beautiful one, not like this.
It's absolutely unbearable. And just, you know, in the past week and a half, it's been nothing but, you know, these constant photos and videos of these tiny, tiny little babies and toddlers just emaciated beyond belief. And you said at the beginning that, you know, the UN has classified this stage of starvation as the fifth stage, the most dangerous, because even if, you know, food was allowed in by Israel, tomorrow, a lot of the damage of this starvation campaign against Palestinians, especially the smallest and the most vulnerable, is irreversible. How are people dealing with this? How does one even cope?
Yeah, actually, this starvation didn't affect on only kids and the children. It's more effectively and deep effectively on the, for example, on journalists. They are suffering during their work, and also doctors during the hospitals. They don't eat any meals for days, and they are still working and continuously. And also, as you see, people are starting to drink water and put salt in it. And this is the reality, not there something like from imaginations or something like this. Many people do the same. And also, it's as you see, Noura, it is the level 5, and it's the most worst thing, and people are start dying, not also only kids and adults. We are read each hour, I read there are someone die because of hunger here in Gaza, adults, youth, children, babies, and everyone here are supposed to die because of hunger if there is nothing in Tar Gaza. And also people, when people are trying to find a simple situation or any small hope to feed their children and go to Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is most and more risk. And when people go to there, they are believe that may they killed, but they take this risk just to feed their children. And when they arrive there, maybe they are shooting them. And as you see in the news, there are 20 kids was die because of gas at that area. And also when people are in this in the north and south going to get some ads from American foundations, which is called Gaza Humanitarian Foundations, they killed 100 person last day, and it's so dangerous. And people are between two choices: die because of hunger or die because of while they searching and seek for food for their children. Mm.
So you mentioned, you used the term level 5, and I just want to describe for people what that is. This comes from the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, which is an internationally accepted definition of famine, which is used by the UN World Food Program, by the European Union, by Oxfam, by various other international agencies. And they, as you said, classify famine into 5 phases, and 5 is the most serious phase. And they define that as in the following way: households have an extreme lack of food and or other basic needs, even after full employment of coping strategies. Starvation, death, destitution, and extremely critical acute malnutrition levels are evident. So that does seem to describe the situation in Gaza, that this is now at a point where people have run out of ways to cope with this famine. Maybe they had food stored with them, now that's used up. The markets are empty. What, Dunya, people all over the world are watching this situation in anguish and shock that their governments are not doing anything except talking. People are protesting. People are being arrested in different countries because they protest, but their governments are not moving yet. I don't want to say they won't, because we don't want to lose hope. But what are people in Gaza saying? Or are they even paying attention to what is happening in the rest of the world? What's the message to people outside?
Yes, on the last Thursday, I get a message from one of your followers on Electron Intifada, and he was saying to us, we are missing you, and we are thinking of you. And I, at that moment, I believe that the people around the world are caring about us. They are trying their best to change the situations here. But even if they cannot change it, but they are trying their best, and we are appreciate that. We are appreciate that highly, and we believe that someday we will be free, and their efforts will get valuable things, and we look for each simple thing around us in the world talking about Gaza, because we get hope from that things. We don't have anything to do here in Gaza, so we need hope from the world, and need something change, something help and support us.
Dunya, are you able to write during this time? You're such an incredible writer. And I know you're also in the middle of medical school. You're going to be a healthcare worker, a physician, a healer. What is motivating you right now? Are you able to write about this? Are you able to record, you know, this horrific moment in any way that you can?
Actually, it's not easy to write and do anything in this day, because it's very hard, but we are also try our best to write, to record everything. As you told, I start studying medicine, and I hope I can record every story in the hospitals that have pain and have story to tell the world about. And I'm looking and working on this, because each one here in Gaza have a story. So the world need to know each story.
Dunya, it's such a privilege to listen to you and to talk to you, and we're so grateful that you traveled a long distance to be able to find the internet and to come and talk to us. And we missed you very much. It's been a few weeks since we spoke to you, and we take a tremendous amount of hope from seeing you, from hearing you, from knowing that you are still working with determination for a future. And you must be very, very tired. You must be very exhausted. And yet you are still going. And so the message we take from you is that we also cannot be too tired to continue our work and to continue speaking out and to speak every day and every hour about what's happening in Gaza. We wish we could send you more than words of encouragement. We wish there was a way to send food, to send medicine, to send the things people in Gaza need. Above all, we wish there was a way to end this genocide and end this horror right now. But I want you to know, on behalf of everyone who is watching and listening, that each one of us, wherever we are, will continue to use our voices to speak about Gaza, to challenge our governments who continue to allow Israel to do this. We won't stop doing that, no matter what.
Yes, actually, I thank you, and I believe that you are doing your best, and I appreciate your efforts. And also, I wanted to add something that is from my youngest sister asked me to say hello to you and everyone watches this live stream. And also, I'm thankful for my friends who are translated my book and trying to sell it in more than one country in the world. And I appreciate each little and small actions that are make people around the world aware about what's happening here in Gaza.
I want to ask you another question, Dunya, and thank you for that, and thank you for all your extraordinary work. What are you most looking forward to doing when this genocide is over and when Gaza and Palestine are free?
For sure, I will take a trip for each city of Palestine. And for, I think, little child and kids here in Gaza have plans for this moment, because my little sister each day writes something like she wants to do if the genocide ends. And she tell me, I will do this and this and this. And I see to her that it will be someday soon.
Inshallah.
And I hope it comes.
And just tell us, what are some of the things that your sister wants to do when this genocide ends? What are some of the things she told you or she wrote?
Actually, the most things she are caring about and want to do, which is return to their schools. So I bring some books to her, and she are start studying, because she are love studying their schools and the classmates, and she are also asking to go to zoo and some trips around the city, because she was so kind and so lovely these places at the city, and she are asking each day when she know that there are many attacks in the city. She asking us, this are this place still, and or this place from? She are worried about each place in the city.
Well, hopefully, you know, it will be rebuilt even better than it was before. That's what so many of our friends and colleagues are saying in Gaza, and we'll be there, and we can't wait to actualize that as soon as possible. Dunya, you are just so extraordinary, and like Ali said, we're all just so proud of you, and we want this to stop, and thank you.
Thank you, Dunya, and please give our love and my love to your sister and to all your family. We pray for you all to be safe. We pray for this to end. On behalf of everyone who's watching, we love you. We think about you. We won't stop talking about Gaza. And whatever hope we can give you through speaking out, through continuing, through our social media, through every platform we have to keep talking about Gaza, to keep demanding an end to this crime, we will keep doing it. That's our promise to you. Until we meet very soon, inshallah, in better days ahead.
Inshallah. Thank you, and much love to you and to everyone watching this live from me and my little sister Noha. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you, Dunya.
That was recorded earlier. Our contributor, Dunya Abusitta, she is a writer and a teacher and a med student. She also wrote a book called Pieces, which you can search for online, Dunya Abusitta, Pieces. She's just extraordinary, and I mean, I don't know. I worry about her constantly, of course.
Yeah, and Dunya is an extraordinary person, and Gaza is full of extraordinary people who all deserve to live a normal life, a safe life, and they're being murdered and starved by our governments.
Yeah, it just continues to be unbearable. But this is what we can do. This is what we keep doing. So we wanted to just talk about a few kind of political developments before we go to John's resistance report. Ali, can you talk about, you know, the EU? I mean, you mentioned in the interview with Dunya, you know, the EU and other Western genocide profiteers, you know, are once again condemning, you know, the level five catastrophic starvation in Gaza. They're condemning it. They're warning. They're, you know, making all of these declarations. But as we always say, Palestinians can't eat statements. They can't eat condemnations. Talk about the European Union and its latest statement.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on the discussion we had with our colleague David Cronin last week about how member states of the European Union, they had that meeting more than a week ago where they were supposed to consider sanctions on Israel. And this came after a review, an official review concluded that Israel is in breach of fundamental human rights obligations contained in the EU-Israel Association Agreement. But they voted to impose zero sanctions, zero consequences. And that EU-Israel Association Agreement gives Israel special trade privileges and other benefits. But instead of imposing even the most modest sanctions, the EU's foreign minister, Kaya Kallas, announced that Israel had agreed to voluntarily allow a bit more aid into Gaza. Those commitments had no clear parameters, no timelines, and no enforcement mechanism. And Kaya Kallas even said, as David Cronin told us last week, she even said that the goal is not to punish Israel. But the language of the Genocide Convention, of which every European Union member state is a signatory, states clearly that signatories have an obligation to prevent and punish the crime of genocide. So international law actually requires punishment of Israel. Amnesty International, as you'll also recall, Nora, condemned the EU's decision not to impose any consequences on Israel as a green light for more genocide. And to absolutely no one's surprise, and as we just saw in the news and we heard from Dunya, that is exactly what has happened. Now, on Tuesday, and this came exactly a week after the EU decision to do nothing, Kaya Kallas posted the following on Twitter. She wrote, "The killing of civilians seeking aid in Gaza is indefensible." And she said, "I spoke again with Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar to recall our understanding on aid flow and made clear that the IDF must stop killing people at distribution points." And then she says, "All options remain on the table if Israel doesn't comply, doesn't deliver on its pledges." So just how seriously should we take this? Well, this is what Gideon Saar, the Israeli foreign minister, responded on Twitter. So what he wrote is he confirmed that he spoke on the phone with Kaya Kallas, the EU foreign minister, about the situation in Gaza. And he says, quote, "I told her that Hamas is waging a campaign of lies while deliberately creating friction between the civilian population, the aid distribution centers, and the IDF. Hamas is the one shooting civilians and torturing them when they try to collect the aid. While Israel said yes to a hostage deal and ceasefire, Hamas is dragging its feet and sabotaging the negotiations." So it's very clear here, as we can see from what Gideon Saar said, that Israel does not even recognize the existence of any deal with the EU or any obligation under international humanitarian law. It's continuing to starve and massacre Palestinians openly while lying and blaming Hamas for the lack of food and for the mass killings at the supposed aid sites that everyone can see and international agencies and people on the ground are saying that Israel is committing. There's no doubt about that. And yet she says all options remain on the table. And that's where the options have always been, on the table.
Yeah.
This tweet by Omar Al-Ayat caught my attention. He just gathered, really, he put together a bunch of headlines that show how the EU has issued four separate warnings to Israel since May, and yet those options remain on the table. You can see that we can just cycle through them, that they keep making these threats. So, yeah, and then on Monday, so this is now this past Monday, and this came after the EU declined to impose any sanctions. 25 countries, most of them members of the European Union, but there were a few others like Japan and Norway and Switzerland, issued a joint statement that begins, and I quote, "We, the signatories listed below, come together with a simple, urgent message. The war in Gaza must end now." And they say the suffering of civilians in Gaza has reached new depths. The Israeli government's aid delivery model is dangerous, fuels instability, and deprives Gazans of human dignity. We condemn the drip feeding of aid and the inhumane killing of civilians, including children seeking to meet their most basic needs of water and food. And they say that the Israeli government is denying essential humanitarian assistance to the civilian population. So they're clear, these governments, even though they're EU governments, many of them strongly supporting Israel, are clear that Israel is denying humanitarian assistance to people.
But what are they going to do about it? I mean, that's always, yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the thing, is that they could have put some muscle behind their words by actually imposing sanctions. And as we talked about last week, they were given 10 proposals, everything from suspending the EU-Israel Association Agreement to perhaps lesser sanctions, but they chose nothing. I mean, they could have done something and they chose nothing. But I want to point out that you know, we're going to have more to say about Germany in a minute, but Germany was notably absent among the list of signatories of this statement. Germany would not even sign a statement calling on Israel to stop starving Palestinians. That's how far gone Germany is.
I mean, I think it was always that way. It was just kind of, you know, like the ebbs and flows of masking it for the last 80 years or longer. I mean, we know what Germany did in Southern Africa, of course. You know, I just, well, talk more about that. Talk more about Germany's conspicuous absence and why that's significant.
Well, yeah, as we discussed last week, it was our colleague David Cronin's opinion that Germany is the biggest obstacle to any EU sanctions, and that next to the United States, Germany is the most important enabler and supporter of Israel's genocide. And I think that message is getting through. I want to point to a story. This comes from the Southern California TV station, KTLA. And they put this story and this headline on Twitter, and there's a story attached to it. And the tweet and the story say, quote, "A hateful message was spray painted on the German consulate in downtown Los Angeles on Monday morning. Multiple people were seen trying to scrub and power wash the messages off the wall." And you can actually see in the photo what this supposedly hateful message was. What's the hate speech against Germany that was on this graffiti? Quote, "Germany starves babies in Gaza."
Yeah, and that's factual. Yeah,
it's just a fact. It's just a fact that Germany is helping Israel to starve babies in Gaza. The proof of that is Germany would not even sign a verbal statement asking Israel to stop starving babies in Gaza. They wouldn't even join the UK and France. I mean, these pro-Israel countries, Germany couldn't even stand with them.
And but pointing that out is supposedly anti-Germanic hate speech.
Hate speech, apparently. Yeah. Yeah. So, like, it's anti-German hate to point out that Germany is again doing genocide.
We live in hell. Ali, can you talk a little bit about a new report published by some solidarity groups in Germany about the extreme levels of repression there? I mean, we're seeing what's happening in the UK. We're, of course, living in the US. But what's happening specifically in Germany?
Yeah, I just want to point quickly to this new report published this month called Repression of Palestine Solidarity in Germany. And it's a really detailed research report put together by a number of solidarity groups in Germany and supported by the European Legal Support Center. And it's available at that URL, palestinaspricht.de/news, if you want to read the whole report. But just to give you a summary, it says that the German state is actively enabling and supporting the genocide in Gaza, even after the International Court of Justice issued an interim ruling alerting all states to a potential genocide case. It's in this light that Palestinians in the Palestine Solidarity Movement in Germany are facing an escalating campaign of political repression that spans law enforcement abuses, legal sanctions, and censorship. And it just gives this overview. There's a lot of detailed information in the report. But in an overview, it says that basically since the start of the genocide, Germany escalated repression through ideological citizenship tests, Schengen-wide bans on Palestinian speakers like Dr. Hassan Obusite, and unprecedented deportations of EU and US citizens for protest participation. Protest restrictions intensified with language bans, excessive force and surveillance. International condemnation followed from the UN and Amnesty, marking a significant erosion of Germany's human rights reputation. And they detail all this. It's just important to know because, the heart of the repression, the thuggery, the authoritarianism is in the countries that sing the loudest about how much they love human rights and democracy. And of course, I faced myself now two separate travel bans issued by the German authority, and I was threatened with prison and a fine for speaking to an audience in Germany via the internet, which I did anyway. I mean, I'm not going to take orders from the Germans.
No.
But, you know, this is a notable report.
Yeah.
Because we want to highlight that this repression is, yes, it's in the US, yes, it's in the UK, it's across the West.
That's right. And don't forget, you were detained and imprisoned by the German side of Switzerland 6-7 months ago.
Indeed. And I don't have more to say about that now, but we are still challenging that in court. So I can't wait until I can update people on it. But that is not forgotten either.
No. All right. Well, turning to the U.S., let's talk about someone who, I mean, our colleague Michael Brown is just a dogged chronicler of one of the most hideous characters in Congress, which is a hideous institution itself. Randy Fine. He's a Florida congressman. Let's talk about what Randy Fine just posted. This is in reference to an ABC News story about 15 people dying of starvation in Gaza. His comment, it's very small there on the screen, but it says, "Release the hostages. Until then, starve away." Ali, if I start talking about how nauseating and despicable this person is, I'll probably be thrown off the air. But why don't you take it away?
You know, we live in an ocean of cruelty, our political culture, where our media, our so-called leaders, revel in the suffering of weak and marginalized people and revel in creating that suffering, whether it's against migrants, whether it's against people who are marginalized in society in any way. They revel in this cruelty. But this comment by Randy Fine, "Until then, starve away," it just, you know, I recall, what was it, a couple of years ago, that Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, two members of Congress, faced censure votes. Yeah. By the entire House of Representatives, including, by the way, from their own Democratic leadership, for some comments that I've even forgotten. They were nothing. It was like a whole storm, yeah, and a manufactured anti-Semitism smear. And the House of Representatives voted to condemn them. And yet these comments by, you know, Randy Fine is one of the worst, but he's by no means unique. Josh Hawley, who is he a senator? I think he's a senator.
He's a senator, remember. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, has made similar comments and others. And it's all just within our political culture, this absolute genocidal depravity. But Randy Fine's comment was almost too much for at least one significant segment of the Israel lobby. He actually drew a mild rebuke for that comment from the American Jewish Committee, a major Israel lobby group.
Who pays his bills, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the job of the American Jewish Committee is to maintain support for Israel across the political spectrum, you know, similar to AIPAC and the ADL. It's in that mix. And what they say in response to Randy Fine's statement that Gazans should starve away, they say, the serious humanitarian situation in Gaza must not be taken lightly, especially by those at the highest levels of government. Implying that starvation is a legitimate tactic is unacceptable. So, you know, on its face, that seems like a reasonable statement. But what I want to point out here is that this is just damage control, because the American Jewish Committee, along with every other major Israel lobby group, has staunchly supported Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza since day one, while demonizing Palestinians and spreading atrocity propaganda aimed at justifying Israel's genocide. All the Israel lobby groups have done that. So this is damage control. Israel's supporters, like Randy Fine and many others, are becoming a liability in a context where a majority of the US public now views Israel negatively. So I think the AJC, the American Jewish Committee, saw Randy Fine's comment and said, you know, I'm speculating here, but they know. We saw that Pew poll from a few weeks ago that now a majority of U.S. adults view Israel negatively, and huge majorities view Israel negatively when you go into sort of different subsections of the population. And they're looking at this and they're saying, this is just going to alienate more people. So they're trying to do damage control by presenting a human face to the Israel lobby, but they have all supported it. So I just wanted to point out that even for the Israel lobby, the open cruelty is becoming too embarrassing.
Right. They want the cruelty to just be less open.
They want to pretend it's, you know, even the way the American Jewish Committee phrases it, they say, the serious humanitarian situation in Gaza. So they don't say, they're not willing to admit that Israel is doing this deliberately.
Right.
They're trying to cover that up.
Yeah, as though it was a natural disaster of sorts. Well, thank you for that. Sorry about that as well. It's always, it's soul crushing to have to cover the just disgustingness of these people. Speaking of which, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez caused a stir. Some people on Twitter were saying that she actually like united the factions of the left in hatred of her over what she did a few days ago. Can you talk about that and why that's significant?
Yeah, and of course we're talking about Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's sort of the most famous celebrity progressive in the Democratic Party in Congress. And I think at a certain point carried a lot of people's hopes, but she just seems to be becoming more and more a sort of a spokesperson for the Democratic Party elite, which is at odds with the vast majority of people who actually vote Democrat. So what happened is on Monday, she posted the following on the social network Blue Sky, and by the way, I don't want to get too down in the weeds, but it's very interesting. She only put this on Blue Sky, which is a fairly small network, not a lot of people on it. She didn't put it on sort of on Twitter, which is a much more, or X as it's called now, a much more widely read platform. And she wrote, quote, "My record on Palestine speaks for itself. I'm proud of it. One of the strongest in Congress. I throw down for pro-Palestine candidates. Largely unrecognized work. That's fine. Disagreements are fine too. But if you want to toss all that for one half-assed MTG stunt, be my guest. I know where I stand." So here she's angrily scolding people for criticizing her and claiming that she's very pro-Palestinian. But let's break down what she means here. She refers to a half-assed MTG stunt. What does that mean? Well, MTG is the initials of Marjorie Taylor Greene, a far-right America firster in Congress, a supporter of Trump, and who has been very Islamophobic and anti-Semitic in the past. Not someone whose politics I would share at all, but she has been more vocal than almost anyone in Congress about opposing foreign aid, including aid to Israel. And last week, she proposed an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill, which basically is the $1 trillion bill to fund the U.S. military-industrial complex. And that went to a vote last week. Her amendment would have cut U.S. military funding to several foreign countries, including $500 million of funding for Israel's Iron Dome. And here's a clip of Marjorie Taylor Greene talking about the military aid that her amendment would cut. And I apologize that this is on the program of the very unsavory Russell Brand, but that just shows you who she, you know, who her politics align with and who she feels comfortable with.
Where were the other ones? $500 million for Jordan, $500 million for Israel, $500 million for Taiwan. So I had entered amendments to strip those monies out. And here was the hypocrisy. They all failed. All of these amendments failed. I also had an amendment to block any funding to go to Ukraine. Ukraine is not a member of NATO. We are not obligated contractually to fund that war, fund that government, pay for anything there. The American people are so tired of it. So when you talk about the disconnect between leaders in Washington, D.C. and the American people, the disconnect is broad and wide.
Yeah. But okay, so she, Marjorie Taylor Greene, total wackadoo, right-wing, you know, zealot, who surrounds herself with other, not just unsavory, but like, Russell Brand himself is, under investigation for sexual assault, I believe.
He has criminal charges for that in the UK. He hasn't faced trial yet.
Right. So anyway, that's where that happened. But Marjorie Taylor Greene wanted to defund Israel's Iron Dome, and that's when AOC got very upset.
Yeah. So what happened is, as we just heard, Marjorie Taylor Greene was saying her amendments failed. In fact, in addition to Greene herself, only five members of Congress voted with her in favor of her amendment, which would cut military aid for Israel and the other countries she mentioned. And I'm going to mention them because I think it's notable. They were Republican Thomas Massie of Kentucky and several progressive Democrats, Al Green of Texas, Summer Lee of Pennsylvania, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, and of course, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. AOC is not one of them. She voted against that amendment. And that prompted a lot of anger at AOC, at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, especially after she tried to defend her vote in the following manner. And so this goes, this was a tweet that she posted actually on Twitter on July 19th, just the day after the vote. And she says, Marjorie Taylor Greene's amendment does nothing to cut off offensive aid to Israel, nor end the flow of U.S. munitions being used in Gaza. Of course, I voted against it. What it does do is to cut off defensive Iron Dome capacities while allowing the actual bombs killing Palestinians to continue. That just created a firestorm of outrage against her, because what she's trying to do here is create a distinction between so-called offensive and so-called defensive weapons for Israel. And of course, all U.S. military aid to Israel is described as defensive. The United States War Ministry is called the Department of Defense. They don't call it the Department of Invasions, Military Coups, and Aggression. That would be an accurate name. They call it the Department of Defense. So everything that is given to Israel is marketed as defensive. Defense. But among the points, I mean, you go through just thousands and thousands and thousands of responses to AOC that are extremely negative. And some of the points that came up, I saw several people making, is that her claiming that Iron Dome is defensive, that's like someone saying, I didn't give the gun to the mass shooter, I only gave him the bulletproof vest.
Right.
You know, that's the equivalent. I thought that was a very vivid analogy, and not far off the mark, given that Israel is using the shield of the Iron Dome in order to mass murder Palestinian children with total impunity. And some other people remark that Israel is perpetrating a Holocaust. You shouldn't be giving them any weapons at all. And to say that you should would be like saying it would have been okay to give so-called defensive weapons to the Nazis during the Holocaust, but not offensive weapons.
Right.
So it's just outrageous. And AOC also tried to defend her vote by arguing that even though she voted against Marjorie Taylor Greene's amendment cutting the Iron Dome funding, she still voted against the defense bill as a whole. But that really cut little ice with her critics. And I guess the reason I want to talk about this is that, to me, well, I think it's notable that AOC was one of the biggest public supporters of Zohran Mamdani, who won the Democratic primary for mayor of New York, and who is in a prime position to be elected mayor of New York in New York City in November. And so, given the pressure he is under from the Israel lobby and from the state of Israel itself, I think it will concern a lot of people that this is where AOC's politics are and where that political alliance might lead. Yeah. And I think maybe the bigger point to me is that it really shows that much of the so-called progressive left in Congress has abandoned the anti-war agenda to the far right, to people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, instead of putting forward a principled anti-war, anti-imperialist agenda. And so people are left with nowhere to turn. And I see people saying, oh, well, Marjorie Taylor Greene isn't a good person, or a stopped clock is right twice a day. That may all be true. But then why is it only Marjorie Taylor Greene putting forward these amendments and making this case? Stand up and do it. You know, let decent people who don't engage in the kind of Islamophobia or anti-Semitism that she has in her record, let them stand up and do this. Don't leave it to Marjorie Taylor Greene. And yet they've completely abandoned the field and people have nowhere to turn. And that is contributing to really the collapse of liberal, so-called liberal and progressive parties, not just in the United States, but across the West, because in the UK, the Labour Party, the party traditionally of the working class, is the party of genocide in Gaza. In Germany, the Greens, a party founded to oppose nuclear weapons and nuclear energy, and to protect the environment and to protect human life is one of the parties of genocide in Gaza. And so this has completely scrambled and destroyed our politics, and where are people supposed to turn?
Yeah. Yeah, it's what, it, you know, it's the definition of controlled opposition. The Democratic Party, you know, is...
It's not even opposition.
It's not. It's really not. It's just controlled party politics. That's the U.S. empire working as it was designed. Well, thanks, Ali. We are going to go to John's resistance report, and then we'll come back with some more discussion with John about the battles that are happening in Gaza, and also talks again of some sort of ceasefire. So this was recorded earlier. Let's go to the resistance report.
Watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada, I am John Elmer. This is the resistance report for day 657 of Israel's genocidal war. Coming up, we have resistance footage from on the ground of the operation that I showed you last week, seen from Israeli drone footage that was leaked by the Israeli military to the state broadcaster. So we see that footage from the point of view of the resistance. That's coming up when we get to northern Gaza. But first, as always, let's start with the maps. And in southern Gaza, we are beginning with this United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs map that I've been using recently, and it's been tracking up to the percentage of the Gaza Strip that is under shoot to kill notices, evacuation notices, ethnic cleansing notices, now above 86%. The Israeli military this week has been reporting between 100 and 120 airstrikes each day, killing most days more than 100 people, as you heard from Nora's always excellent report off the top of the show. And that is a separate tally. That is an airstrikes tally. It's a separate tally from artillery and tank shelling, which, of course, you know are constant in Gaza every single day and have been for the past 657. There's a sense in Israeli military circles that the military is trying to get out of this war. Just this week, the Israeli military chief of staff visited Shajaiya in eastern Gaza City and told troops that they already control 75% of the Gaza Strip, which is, of course, not true, but it would be, it would match the number 75% that Operation Gideon's Chariots was intended to capture in Gaza and destroy, as we're going to see in future maps. Israeli military sources told the Israeli daily Yedioth Ahronot this week that if there's no ceasefire deal, the military will apply pressure through other means besides invading central Gaza, Deir al-Balah, and Gaza City, the two major population concentrations that you can see on that map there. At the top is Gaza City, in the center, that is Deir al-Balah, and the middle camps, and on the bottom of that map to the left along the Mediterranean coast is, of course, Mowasi, the safe zone that Israel attacks every single day, bombing tents in that Mowasi camp. The military analyst this week said that the word from the IDF command is that no further progress can be made in Gaza. Nobody believes that the Qassam brigades could be defeated. And there is significant concern within the Israeli military that Israeli soldiers may get captured. Abu Obeida, the spokesperson for the Qassam Brigade, spoke this week for the first time since March, when Israel returned to war after reneging on the agreement that the United States was the principal guarantor of. Abu Obeida said of the Qassam Brigades, quote, "We strongly support the stance of the Palestinian resistance delegation in indirect negotiations with the enemy. We have repeatedly offered in recent or offensive plans take." Let's take a look at what those plans have rendered Gaza Strip. This is the moonscape that is Rafah. This week, BBC Verified did a report on 40 different erasure sites across Gaza. This is 21 months after the BBC talking over its guests who mentioned genocide as if they were the spokespersons representing the Israeli military. But they had Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on record saying that the objective right now in Gaza is, quote, destroying more and more homes, leaving Palestinians with nowhere to return to. Still, this week, even in that moonscape, there was four operations by Qassam's Rafah Brigade, one fatal and two with serious injuries. They reported on Tuesday that their fighters managed to target a Zionist force consisting of seven soldiers with a television anti-personnel device, causing casualties east of Rafah City. Our fighters monitored the landing of evacuation helicopters. Within a couple of hours, the Israelis reported that the IDF said that two combat engineers, including a platoon commander, were severely wounded and another soldier was hurt during an explosive device operation in southern Gaza's Rafah. So field reports overlapping. I just want to show you this Magan corridor, number three here. This is the corridor that I've described, the Moreg corridor that you see there runs and splits Rafah from Khan Yunis, and this new corridor, the Magan Oz corridor, is cutting off eastern Khan Yunis from Khan Yunis City and the refugee camp to the west, and that is Mawasi that you're seeing, and the coastline is on the top of that map, so that's Mawasi along the coast. But footage shown from satellites this week, if we look at number four here, you can see the Israeli destruction of this corridor. This is a before picture that represents June 20th. And if we see the next slide, you can see what it looks like as of July 17th. This is from satellite imagery from Planet Labs that was collected by Jake Godin. And the destruction of this corridor has been largely the Israeli purpose in this stage of the war. As I reported going back a couple months now, the goal of this war was not to defeat the resistance. It was to take territory and destroy it. And that is what we are seeing: starvation, destruction, and erasure, because the Israelis cannot defeat the resistance. They're taking it out on the civilian population in Gaza. So that is the context for these operations. Now on to the resistance. Qassam commander Abu Obeida, spokesperson, directly addressed the battlefield this week. He said, "Our fighters side by side with the fighters and resistance members from our brother factions, especially our brothers in Sahrawi al-Quds, are engaged in an asymmetric battle with unmatched faith and unbreakable determination. Our fighters have attempted in recent weeks to capture several Israeli soldiers during operations, some of them nearly successful," he said, "were it not for the use of Israel's Hannibal directive, killing the fighters and soldiers themselves in that operation. The strategy," Abu Obeida said, "and decision of the Qassam leadership at this stage of the battle is to ensure deadly blows against enemy soldiers while carrying out focused, high-impact operations at point-blank range and to pursue and capture Zionist soldiers. Our fighters' operations have extended from the far north and east of Beit Hanun and Jabalia in the northern Gaza Strip through the neighborhoods of Al-Tufa, Shajaiya, and Al-Zaytun in Gaza City, reaching all the way to Khan Yunis and Rafah, making Gaza's resistance the greatest military school for a people's resistance confronting its occupiers in modern history. If the enemy government chooses to continue the war of extermination, it is at the same time choosing to continue receiving the coffins of its soldiers and officers. Their tanks will not protect them," Abu Obeida said. And now let's take a look at what Abu Obeida was referring to, because this is operation number six here, this video by Sahrawi al-Quds, number six. Yeah, this is the an operation by Sahrawi al-Quds that took place in Abasan al-Kabira in eastern Khan Yunis. You can see them here with eyes on Israeli units. You can see the excavators there, which would make obvious targets, but because the goal of this operation is to capture soldiers, you see the fighters passing on the excavators and here placing an explosively formed penetrator on the route. Qassam Sahrawi commanders said that they had been on this route for many days planning this operation, so that's why they pass on the excavators. The fighter here says, "We will not leave here except with a captive soldier. or we will be martyrs, a captured soldier or martyrdom. That is this operation that is based out of the rubble in Khan Yunis, which looks is beginning to look a lot like Rafah, complete destruction in especially eastern Khan Yunis. There, the video is showing where the hideout is in the rubble, and you can see the Namur troop carrier traveling in the background. So the fighters here using the rubble, the partially collapsed, the Israelis believe totally collapsed buildings to target this troop carrier that you're going to see get hit here by a massive EFP. And Sara Al-Quds said that this was an advanced model of their explosively formed penetrator. And you're going to see that here in the, we're showing this from two cameras of the fighters, but you're going to see the impact of the IED on the Namur troop carrier significant. There you see the troop carrier entering the frame before it's targeted. Detonated by Sara Al-Quds. Now, this is just the first part of the operation because the fighters are then going to approach the APC here and attempt to capture soldiers. And we've seen this a number of times from all factions. We saw Qassam do this in the same area of Khan Yunis earlier in the month. When they nearly boarded a Namur troop carrier that had the 36th Division commander of the IDF aboard. And here, this video is, we have dropped the audio track as we do on these videos, but you can hear heavy gunfire. You can see the rounds hitting off the rubble there. These fighters are now going to advance into that battle in an attempt to capture the soldiers. Soraya says here that the intervention of the Zionist enemy vehicles near the location hindered the completion of the capture operation, which led to the death of the captured soldier and the martyrdom of our group of fighters. Military sources told Al Jazeera last week that the Hannibal directive had been used in northern Gaza multiple times. And according to Sara Al-Quds, that's what we're seeing here in southern Gaza. Now we are going to move to Deir al-Bala. Number 7 shows this map here. Along the top, you have the Mediterranean coast. We're looking at this map from west to east. This evacuation order in Deir al-Bala earlier this week effectively cuts off the middle camps from Mawasi in the south. And this operation is essentially along the lines of what used to be the along the cutoff in the area of the Abu Holi checkpoint, which was a significant checkpoint in southern, that cut off southern Gaza during the time when Israeli settlers were in Gaza before 2005. And that is the same axis upon which they are operating here. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that since March 18th, when Israel reneged on the ceasefire agreement, more than 55 displacement orders covering more than 85% of Gaza have been issued. According to the UN site management cluster, that has put 750,000 Palestinians newly displaced just in that time since March 18th. And those orders are continuing to go. The Israelis have not invaded the city of Deir al-Bala directly during this war. They have said that they are not doing that because they believe that their captives are in Deir al-Bala, but we know that that is not serious because they have no idea where their captives are anywhere in Gaza. But this operation was immediately met by resistance. Qassam Brigade's field reports immediately came out talking about targeting a Merkava tank with a high explosive ground charge in south of Deir al-Bala. Sara Al-Quds targeted a tank with a pre-planted Takib. That's an explosively formed penetrator. Qassam Brigade's hit a troop carrier with a Yassin 105, another tank with a Yassin 105, and the Israeli military announced an officer was seriously wounded by anti-tank fire in the Deir al-Bala area, the central Gaza Strip, earlier in the day. It was the Technology and Maintenance Corps non-commissioned officer serving in the Golani Brigade's reconnaissance unit. So the reconnaissance unit, the first troops across the border, are hit with these operations by the Deir al-Bala battalion. Let's take a look at those number 7B here. We're going to see three Yassin strikes. against armored vehicles. And again, we've been talking about this for the 21 months of this war, but here it's shown really starkly. The Israeli troops roll into Deir al-Bala and they're immediately hit, and they're hit by the Deir al-Bala battalion, the central camps battalions in the middle camps. This is not fighters chasing around the military. This is fighters in these positions, in their area of responsibility, immediately hitting armored vehicles that enter their area of responsibility. This is the second operation. Again, you're seeing this one. This is a tunnel operation. You can see the fighters emerge from their tunnels in positions that they have been in for 21 months waiting for this battle. They don't run down to Khan Yunis and fight the battle. This is not Khan Yunis fighters coming up to Deir al-Bala. It's fighters in their area of responsibility that we have seen throughout the war. So you can see the cameraman on these two videos encouraging. This is a third now operation, again, another tunnel-borne operation against a Namur troop carrier. You're going to see this is, all three of them are direct hits, but this one in particular, you're going to see a piece of the armored vehicle come flying through your frame there before the fighters emerge back, descend back down into their tunnels. And this is footage of them towing the disabled vehicle with the presumably the one with the wounded, severely wounded soldiers on board. So that is the middle camps area. We're going to move now to the north. Let's take a look at that map of the north. Again, this is a map, an EI original map that we've been showing throughout the war. And the main focus in the north has been along the cross, across the top there in the northeast and northwest, Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia. Beit Hanun has been scheduled for complete destruction, as it already has been half a dozen at least times during the war. But of course, as soon as Israeli troops moved into Beit Hanun a couple of weeks ago, they were hit by a deadly ambush as they were entering Beit Hanun. And that unit that was hit, that was their first time entering, and they were hit within minutes of arriving. In Shujaiya, the operations we're going to watch here are in Zaytun, Shujaiya, and Tufa on the eastern edge of Gaza City, and Jabalia on the eastern side of Jabalia City. And there was just a report by the Israeli state broadcaster on Friday that had Lieutenant Colonel Almag Ben Ami of the 932nd Battalion. He's the commander. And he said in an interview with embedded troops from the Israeli state broadcaster that our mission, he said, quote, our mission is that they'll never have nowhere, they'll have nowhere to go back to. Our mission is that they'll have nowhere to go back to. And the journalist asked, to what depth are you now flattening? And he answers, as much as I can, as fast as possible, until they tell me to stop. So they're not fighting the resistance. They're carrying out a genocidal war against civilians. They're targeting civilian infrastructure in these battles. And if we look at number nine here, we're going to see Saraya al-Quds meet these operations. You can see on the wall there, Saraya has written that your tanks will be reduced to scrap by our fighters. And you can see with the pressure plates, again, this is a return to sender operation using Israeli American anti-tank mines, buried with a pressure plate detonator is what you're seeing here. And as soon as the tank rolls over it here that we're watching here, they detonate it, and it's too heavy. Only heavy vehicles detonate it. So these are a type of IED that we have seen be used frequently, because they work perfectly for heavy armored vehicles and not for other vehicles. This operation is in Zaytun. This is a second operation. Again, you see the anti-tank mines. Those are left behind by Israeli soldiers or captured when they flee. This was used particularly in the second phase of this genocide, when we saw them using these mines to do house demolitions. In this phase of the genocide, they're doing the house demolitions with excavators. So that presumably will lessen the number of these anti-tank mines going forward. But of course, the unexploded ordnance in the numbering in the thousands, if not tens of thousands, will keep the resistance able to fight this battle for a long time to come. You can see the detonation there from a surveillance camera of that operation. This is in Tufa. This is the second of three operations on the eastern edge of Gaza City. All these videos that I'm showing you are from the last week, since you saw me, as ever. Soraya Engineering Battalion, Engineering Corps, here shown again. There's the pressure plate detonator. There's the anti-tank mine. Now, this is multiple anti-tank mines that we've seen stacked as many as four and five high throughout the course of this war, buried in the road. The Israelis have torn up the roads. They have created their own pathways through the urban environment, which just makes burying these IEDs all that much easier for the resistance. And that's what we are seeing here in Soraya's operations. The Israelis reported a number of severe casualties in these operations. In the Shajaiya operation, Channel 12 said that details about the army's announcement of injured soldiers from the paratroopers brigade, that was four seriously injured and two moderately injured, as well as a Yahalom unit. Two soldiers from the Yahalom unit were injured as well. Now, this is the footage that I've been telling you about, number 10 here. This is the Qassam footage from the ground of that operation that I broke down last week that we saw from Israeli drone footage. And here we're getting the view of what it is. You can see the fighter at the top there. He's got a guerrilla action device that he's setting up. While the fighter says that today is the day we have been preparing for to torment this frail army, this army that abuses civilians. The army is outside this house. Between us and them is only one house. So we saw this video from the drone footage, and you're going to see the drone footage again here. But this answers the questions that we had from that first look at the operation. You can see the Merkava tank there through the rubble. And you're going to see the fighter here with his guerrilla action device. This is just like a smaller, lighter Shuad, essentially. And you can see this is the Tandem 85, the Yassin Archer. This is a coordinated operation. We saw it from the drone footage. The Yassin Archer is going to fire at the tank on the right to your screen there. And the Qassam fighter with the guerrilla action device is going to time that with his approach here. You can see him in the left of the screen emerging. And now this is the drone footage. I removed this watermark from the drone footage because the watermark, you can see the fighter in the top left corner there moving. And you can see him there in the bottom left corner moving. The watermark makes no sense because it's released through an Israeli military sensor. So there's no need to stamp the video as if it's some kind of score for the state broadcaster. You can see the significant hit there, rubble flying. And that is from the ground. And it was curious because when we saw the footage from the air, we hadn't seen a field report of this operation. There it is again. You can see him in the top throwing the guerrilla action device on the top of the turret and likely aiming for an open hatch, which we've seen many times throughout this war. So here's the answer of the Qassam's return to their base safely. All right. So, and number 11, Abu Obeida spoke this week. I just wanted to give you a summary of what he said. He said the enemy resumed its barbaric Nazi aggression 4 months ago after betraying and breaking the signed agreement, lying to mediators and to the world, and returning to war in search of its so-called victory. For 4 months, Abu Obeida said, the enemy has continued its sadism against civilians and children, indulging its obsession with systematic destruction of neighborhoods, cities, and civilian residential areas. 21 months summarized in the steadfastness of our fighters and of our people. 21 months of disgraceful abandonment by our Arab and Islamic nations. Of course, he always salutes Yemen, notwithstanding what he's saying there. And in this speech, he also saluted Yemen multiple times. But his target is the Arab and Islamic nations. Our fighters continue to surprise the enemy with new and varied tactics, having drawn lessons from the longest war in our people's history. They've carried out bold, unique, and high-level operations. The world witnessed our fighters climbing onto enemy vehicles in Khan Yunis, reaching the occupying soldiers at point-blank range, pursuing a criminal soldier who specialized in demolishing civilian homes and finishing him off and seizing his weapon. those are all operations that I showed you in the last few weeks on this show. Abu Obeida said, "We are proud of our fighters and we are deeply aware of the pain and suffering endured by our wounded people, whose pain we live with day by day. Our enemy is supplied by the most powerful oppressive forces in the world with endless convoys of weapons and ammunition, while the regimes and powers of the Arab and Islamic nations look on in silence. We say this to history with all bitterness and pain and in front of all the sons and daughters of our nation. O leaders of this Islamic and Arab nation, O its elites and its major parties, you are our adversaries before God. You are the adversaries of every orphan child, every grieving mother, every displaced, homeless, wounded, devastated, and starving person. Your necks are burdened with the blood of tens of thousands of innocents who were betrayed by your silence. May the eyes of the cowards never sleep. Salutations to the free people of the world who are striving to show solidarity with Gaza, to break the siege, and to lift the oppression on our people by all means. All initiatives and expressions of solidarity from peoples all over the world are a source of pride and honor for our people." And he signed off with kisses to the heads of all the elders of our patient and steadfast people. So that is Abu Obeida. He delivered that address on the 651st day of the war. And that is the resistance report for day 657 of this genocidal war.
Thank you so much, John. And yeah, there were a couple of glitches in the stream, so just want to remind our audience that once this live stream is over, we will be posting the individual segments, and one of them will be John's full unglitched, uncut segment there. So thank you for that. And I mean, what do we say? You know, talk about the significance of the Abu Obeida speech a little bit more. I mean, it was, you know, it's interesting that the resistance is following, you know, this last iteration of so-called ceasefire negotiations very closely. There are, of course, demands, the continuous demands by Israel that the resistance disarm and surrender. Where are we in terms of trying to suss this out?
Yeah, I mean, Abu Obeida said that he was that they were following the negotiations, but Qassam and the resistance factions in a unified front are not going to surrender at this moment in the war, in their people's liberation struggle. It just can't happen that way. And Israel's, you know, all of the ceasefire talks are between Israelis. They're between Israelis and they're between Americans and Israelis. And then they take their proposal to Hamas in and it's rejected because the proposal is essentially a surrender agreement, which would guarantee Israeli occupation at least indefinitely, if not permanently, in the Gaza Strip. It changes the aid mechanism from the established, dignified United Nations system to this GHF massacre sites. It doesn't guarantee people can return home. It's a partial agreement that doesn't deal with an end to the war. And Qassam's principles on this have been the same for 656 of these days. They basically right away said that they were willing to exchange prisoners, but they're not going to cede on their national sovereignty in this situation. And it's brutal because Israel's strategy is literally starving children to death. But the future with surrender doesn't change. It doesn't all of a sudden Gaza turns into a free zone where people live happily ever after. It just entrenches this permanent regime of cruelty that we've been watching and reporting on for the last 2 hours. So there's no ceasefire agreement, and I don't see one unless Israel is willing to end the war, unless the United States is willing to guarantee that. But what's that worth when the guarantee right. was just made on the last deal? And the crossings have to be opened. The siege has to end. This war has to end the siege. That is, those are principles that the Palestinians cannot concede to Israel.
Yeah. Ali, what's your take? Witkoff is back again in the region. Where are we? Is there any reason to be hopeful?
I largely agree with John, and that's why I haven't been talking much about the ceasefire talks, because at this point it seems like just a cruel game. We all know that if the United States wanted to end this, if Israel wanted to end it, they could end it. They could, you know, an agreement has been possible from the start. It's not like there's these complicated issues and they're trying to bridge these gaps and they just can't get there. It's that they don't want an agreement. But that said, I think, you know, we should inform ourselves as to what is supposedly going on, or what is at least what the motions are. For that, I wanted to point out some reporting from Jeremy Scahill of Dropsite News, that we, you know, who we interviewed some weeks ago, because he follows the ceasefire, so-called ceasefire negotiations, very closely. And he put out an update this morning, and I'll just go over the points he makes quickly, and maybe you or John have some comments on it too. He says, a few notes on the state of the Gaza ceasefire negotiations. Hamas has now submitted its response to the Israeli crafted framework, and Netanyahu responded by announcing he would recall his negotiating team from Doha. And he says, and I think this is about optics, he says, Israel has been pushing a narrative via leaks to mostly Hebrew media that Hamas is taking a hard line and obstructing a deal. This is totally false. So again, this is the pattern we've seen from the start. Hamas agrees. They say, fine, maybe some minor amendments, and then Israel and the United States move the goalposts. And some of the ridiculous conditions that Israel is trying to impose, again, not in order to achieve agreement, but in order to prevent agreement, are things they know that are absolutely impossible for Hamas or any other Palestinian to accept. So, for example, he says Israel put forward a proposal to effectively occupy huge swaths of Gaza indefinitely, including building a large concentration camp in Gaza. So a concentration camp within a concentration camp. Hamas, of course, rejected this because this is not a negotiation. It is a declaration of intent to continue the mass extermination expulsion. So again, you know, Hamas always tries to deal with these things practically. And he says that they put forward, they showed a willingness to agree to Israeli troop withdrawal and redeployment maps that would still allow significant Israeli-imposed buffer zones encircling Gaza. So they're trying to find every possible way to end this, to give the people of Gaza relief. Because as John pointed out, the Israelis are not trying to defeat the resistance. They're not fighting soldier to soldier. While the resistance is fighting the Israeli army is murdering civilians and destroying their homes as part of a plan for ethnic cleansing and genocide so that no one can come back. They're saying it openly. So, sadly, I think there's not much hope to be put in the negotiations. What, you know, Jeremy gives some more detail that people can read on his Twitter account, which is just his name, Jeremy Scahill. But again, I think that there's two factors that are going to make a difference here to getting a negotiation. First and foremost, the resistance. If they can inflict enough pain on the Israeli army to force Israel to agree to a ceasefire and an end to the war. And that's their strategy. That's what we've seen, as John has been showing us. June was the deadliest month for the Israeli army in Gaza in more than a year. And July is proceeding along a similar pattern. Abu Ubaida's speech, which came after a long video absence. Abu Ubaida had been putting out written statements, but we hadn't seen him on video. It was a very strong, the language of what he said didn't appear to show any sort of change in the basic approach. In other words, doing everything possible to defend the people is how Abu Ubaida talked about it. Willingness to achieve a ceasefire if the basic terms are met of ending the war and unrestricted humanitarian aid and Israeli withdrawal. But I think what was very significant is he said, we're ready for a long war of attrition. We're ready for a long war of attrition. So they realize that the negotiations are not, that you can't achieve negotiations without, to use Netanyahu's term, military pressure. So Hamas is putting, and the resistance factions are putting military pressure on Israel by stepping up the targeting of their soldiers and attempting to capture them, as they've said openly. And then the other factor is going to be external pressure.
Yeah.
We talked about how the governments are not putting pressure on Israel yet, but that's where people power comes in and cannot let up.
Yeah.
There was a big protest just yesterday in New York City. There's a protest in Chicago today. There are actions all over the country and all over the world. And that pressure has to step up and continue.
Yeah. I mean, I was watching footage from a massive protest in Morocco over the weekend. And those, you know, I mean, I'm always reminded of the port workers in Marrakesh and Tangiers that are stopping their work. They will not unload or load ships bound for Israel, specifically the ships that are carrying weapons that are shredding Palestinians to bits. And that's where the pressure is also going to come, is the economic pressure. You know, Yemen is still enforcing its humanitarian intervention.
They shut down Eilat. Eilat is now officially right. Bankrupt and closed.
That's right. One of Israel's biggest and most important ports is closed.
Well, one of its three ports. It only has three ports capable of handling container traffic, and one of them is out of commission. And, you know, so if that's what Yemen can do, what could the EU do? What could the Arab states do? What could Egypt do if they decided to say, we're opening Rafah and we're letting the trucks in and we're going to send, you know, guards for the trucks? They could do that.
Yeah.
They choose not to.
Right. John, what can you say about the role that Egypt could play and why they keep doing the bidding of Israel and the West?
Well, their regime is completely funded by the United States as part of their peace treaty with Israel. They're the second most funded American-funded military system. And I think that that's the answer. If they were to do something differently, that aid gets called into question and their regime itself is called into question. But, you know, you have the Abu Ubaida's speech was very harsh on the Arab states and the Arab leaders and the governments, which we hadn't really seen him take the time to do that before. He said it before. I mean, he said it earlier in the war in a real famous way when he said he kind of mocked the Arab states who he said are watching all of our videos. And he said, well, you're sitting on your hands, like, don't worry about it. You know, you could get humanitarian aid in, but we'll fight this battle ourselves. We're not asking for your soldiers. We'll fight with what we built with our own hands. And that was a real strong statement early in the war. And he hasn't spent a ton of time in his messages definitely not as harsh as in this last message. And I think, the disconnect between those governments and those elites, which is what he pointed out. He's not saying the people, of course. He's saying the elites. He pointed that directly, the governments. That they're going to go down in history at this point. We're getting to such a brutal point. I mean, we're two plus hours into this show, and everybody knows at this point in the show what is happening in Gaza. We're at a point right now that is very, very scary and is a real precipice for widespread catastrophe amongst children, civilians, the weakest members of society, the smallest members of society. And there's a lot that the neighboring governments could do. Israel's dependent on fuel shipments. They're dependent on food shipments. They're dependent on weapons shipments that come on ships that could be stopped. So there's many ways that the Arab states could be participating in stopping this war, and they've chosen the opposite.
It's so shameful.
They've chosen to participate.
Yeah.
And for all of us who are watching, and particularly for people who have family in Gaza, I mean, first and foremost, it goes without saying, the people who are suffering, the people in Gaza. But I'm talking about for those of us who just in disbelief. I was talking with a colleague yesterday, and I would say I was naive to think that the world wouldn't allow Israel to go this far. There was a point where I thought Israel wouldn't allow it.
Yeah.
I was wrong. It's hard to understand. It's hard to comprehend what we're seeing now.
Israelis didn't think they could do it either.
They didn't think they could do it, and they keep pushing, and they find that it's an open door. The EU, all options are on the table, and that's where they'll remain, on the table. And they're becoming more brazen in the West Bank. The other day, I think it was yesterday, the Knesset passed a resolution, a non-binding resolution, but by a large majority supporting the annexation of the West Bank. Yeah. More important than that is that they're implementing it on the ground with the continued destruction in refugee camps, the killing of children. The killing of three children in the West Bank would have been a major headline at one. It's a catastrophe. Yeah. It's a horror. It would have been a major headline, but it's barely a footnote against the massacres every day in Gaza. But this is happening in the West Bank. We talked a little bit about Syria last year with the carve up of Syria and the destruction of Syria as a state. And many people think that Israel may relaunch a full-scale war on Lebanon. I want to remind us and remind myself of something Ilan Pappé said on this live stream, but he also has said it many other times. We had him on some months ago, and we've had him on several times, and he said from near the beginning of this genocide that his sense is that the next year, the next 2 years are going to be the worst we've ever seen. But that his conviction is that Israel is finished, that there is light at the end of the tunnel. We have to go through, or we will, we don't have to. It's Israel's choice and it's the U.S. choice. We will go through the absolute worst and emerge to something better. And he made that point again in another podcast. I think it was Makdisi Street, just in recent days. And I agree with him. That remains true. And the reason I'm saying that is not just to make us feel better when the anguish is constant, but because we have to believe in a future. And we have to believe in a realistic future. And I think that is realistic. I still think it's realistic. But it depends on us to continue the pressure. History doesn't just happen. People make it. And we're part of making it. And we have to use our voices to keep pushing for that better future. And we all heard what Dunya said and what Asim said last week and what our friends in Gaza always tell us, that our voices, our speaking out, our showing up, give people hope and give people in Gaza hope, the hope to hold on, to survive for another day and another day and another day. And we have to give them that nourishment as well.
Hang in there, everybody. It's not easy to wake up in the mornings and look at the news and the horrors that are just constant and streaming. Now is not the time for giving up and falling into the pit of despair. Now is the time for organizing and being loud and being louder and doing whatever you can. And that's really it. Let's take a quick look at the website while, Ali, you talk about some of the donors that we want to thank this week, because there are many and we are always so grateful.
Why don't you start? Go ahead and talk about the website while I pull up the names of the people I want to thank this week, because great. I didn't have them up right away.
Sprung it on you.
Yeah.
On this week on the website, we're always publishing features and analyses. We even have book reviews, of course, and news items by our own staff members. This week, I mean, the story that I read during the news report from Asim al-Nabih in Gaza City is, it's a heart-crushing read. He talks about, of course, his nieces and nephews, how he bought a bar of chocolate at the end of the piece, which I didn't get to read. I encourage everyone to go to electronicintifada.net and read Asim's feature right there at the top, The Dreams We Carry During Genocide. He talks about where his own children are, including his young daughter. They are not in Gaza, and he talks about why and where they are and how just wrenching it has been over the last 2 years to not be with them. Asim's own dreams, during this genocide.
He's such an extraordinary writer and thinker and engineer and father and husband and son. I mean, you Asim, the way he expresses himself, he's an incredible person, and his writing, I think, can reach people in a way that many others can't. So please share his work. Please go back to our channel and share his interview with your friends, your family, the segment from last week. We put it up as a separate segment where he told that extraordinary story of the date. And of course, we also have a summary of last week's show, as usual, the live stream. We write it up, so that's there if you want to go back or if you ever miss a show. I also want to point out this story on the front page about Dell, the computer company. Many of us have Dell computers or Dell equipment in our homes or our offices. This is one of the big technology companies. And this is a scoop, actually, by Omar Zahzah, who obtained internal documents showing how Dell Technologies is far more deeply and directly involved in this genocide than had been previously known. There was some information about Dell, but Omar really obtained some previously unknown information about Dell's supplying of the Israeli military, including its intelligence and the army and the air force, with key technology that they're using in this genocide. And there's a really sort of interesting point in this story where Omar had written to Dell to get their comment before we published the story. He wrote to Dell and put forward all of the information to ask their response. And he says that they initially sent him a statement just of the usual pablum about how they're committed to human rights and committed to the law. And then he says, then bizarrely, the company which uses Outlook for communications apparently tried to recall the statement it sent this journalist. But since the message had already been opened, its contents were still available. So they sent us an email with a statement and then they tried to withdraw it. So what's going on there? But interestingly, in that statement, they didn't deny anything in this story.
No,
they didn't deny anything. So this is some solid investigative reporting by Omar Zahzah. And we'll try to get him on because he's writing. He has a book coming out on the role of tech in this genocide. And so we'll try to have him on in coming weeks to talk more about this. But extraordinarily good reporting.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So yes, go to electronicintifada.net to read Omar's latest piece, as well as Awesome's feature, so many other features that we have on EI. Ali, tell us about our wonderful, generous donors this week.
Well, our community is what keeps us able to do this work. It's what keeps us on air. It's what keeps the website up. It's what allows us to continue supporting our writers in Gaza and to allow them to support their families, even in these dire circumstances. And it supports everything else that we do, from this live stream from beginning to end, the news report, John's incredible reporting every week, which, you know, he works the whole week to bring us this meticulous, detailed reporting. And everything else we do is thanks to our community and our supporters. So I want to say thank you to each and every person who has ever made a donation to support our work. And I wish I could name all of you, but I will just mention a few. Claudia, Alexander, Rashwan, Riaz, Genevieve, Lewis, Nadine, Anne, Juan, and Khaled. So thank you to each one of you and to every other person, whether you've given a one-time gift or whether you go to electronicintifada.net and hit donate now. You can give a one-time gift, or you can give a monthly donation of, I think, as little as, I think, technically, you can't do less than $5. It's just the way the system is built. But there's people who give $5. There's people who give more. Whatever you can do to support this work is deeply appreciated. And as always, this is a solidarity model. So everything we do, all this work and information, is free for everyone in the world forever. We will never charge for it. We will never put up a paywall. We'll never ask you to for a paid subscription. So when you make a donation, you help us to make this information available to the whole world for free.
Thanks, Ali. And of course, like and subscribe on all of our media channels, YouTube, Rumble, Twitch, Instagram, Facebook, all of those. And of course, sign up for our email list at electronicintifada.net. And I want to say a special thank you to Ellie Gerzon this week, who is filling in for our dear Tamara Nassar, who is taking a well-deserved break this week. Thank you, Ellie. And thank you to everyone at the Electronic Intifada. And on behalf of myself, John, Ali, Ellie, and Tamara, and Asa, who's also still away on break, thank you all, and we will see you next week.
Thank you.